This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you were alive in the 70s, you probably know a lot of the Carpenters records. They were played so much, they were part of the pop soundtrack of the decade. Songs like Close to You, We've Only Just Begun, Rainy Days and Mondays, Superstar, Goodbye to Love, and Yesterday Once More. My guest Richard Carpenter was half of the duo. The other half was his sister, Karen Carpenter. Karen was the lead singer and drummer. Richard chose the songs, co-wrote some of the songs, did the arrangements, and sang backup vocals. Karen died in 1983 from complications of anorexia. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the Carpenters signing with A&M Records, the label that was co-founded by Herb Alpert. To mark the 40th anniversary, a Carpenters collection has been released featuring 40 of their songs. It's called 4040. Let's start with Rainy Days and Mondays, which was written by Roger Nichols and Paul Williams.
Talking to myself and feeling old. Sometimes I'd like to quit. Nothing ever seems to fit. Nothing to do but frown. Rainy days and Mondays always get me down. What I've got they used to call the blues. Nothing is really wrong. Feeling like I don't belong.
Richard Carpenter, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with your first big hit, which is Close to You, which is written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. You had just been signed to A&M Records, the record label that Herb Alpert co-founded. And then, like, not long after you were signed, he, if I get the story right, he gave you this song. And what happened?
We'd signed in April of 69, and we had a single released in October of that year that was doing fairly well. It was a ballad version, my take on Ticket to Ride.
The Beatles song.
Yeah. And during this time, Herb Alpert brought a lead sheet of a rather obscure Bacharach David song called They Long to Be Close to You. And I looked at the lead sheet. I say a lead sheet, for those who may not know, is just the melody, the chord changes, and the lyric. There's no intro, no outro, no arrangement. It's for to have something to look at so they get to know the song to do their own arrangement. So when I saw the end of on the lead sheet of In Your Eyes of Blue, the melody, I got exactly what Herb was talking about, the brum brum on the piano. But that's it. He wanted me to just, as I said, arrange it the way I felt it should go.
The opening piano part that you play on Close to You has become kind of like an official part of the melody. So how did you come up with that?
Yeah, what it is it's mostly the end. As I was putting the chart together, it would have ended, just like me, they long to be close to you. And that was, I mean, it had a little more of an ending, but to me that wasn't enough. So I pictured a hook or a tag that would be a four-part harmony overdubbed and close to you. And then again, close to you. And that became one of the selling points, if you will, of that record. I mean, it had a lot going for it, but that ending certainly was one of them.
One more question about Close to You. There's that trumpet break
in
the middle, and that's almost like a signature of Burt Bacharach arrangements. And the trumpeter sounds just like the trumpeter Bacharach used in his recordings from the 60s, which always kind of sounded a little like Herb Alpert.
Keeping it all in the family.
Did you do that intentionally?
I did that intentionally. When I went in to work on the arrangement, took this lead sheet with me, it was like WWB do, you know, what would Bacharach do? and so I kept that in mind while I was arranging it. But even that was a little bit of a tip of the hat. Well, not only to Bert with, say, the little tag on the end of Raindrops Keep Falling in My Head that really has nothing much to do with what preceded it, but it's really magical. So when I got through the first chorus of Close to You, I felt it should modulate, and I pictured the trumpets. And yeah, it's Bacharach-esque, but I wanted a little what's called a doit.
A what?
On the trumpet. Doit, or well, I can't call it. It looks like do it when you mark it into the chart, D-O-I-T. It's just slang for, it's a little bend. And anyone who's familiar with the record will know when the trumpets, and it's all one fellow, by the way. His name Chuck Findley. He's one of the top players in town. And then I had him triple it. So there are three of them overdub playing in unison. But I wanted ba 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 bum ba da bum ba ba that ba ba. But it was difficult to get because I say originally we had for the sweetening the orchestra and all had three trumpets, and they were all top notch players. But when it came to that little duet, each one interpreted it differently. So it was a little bit of a train wreck every time they played it. So ultimately, of course, as I said, it needed to be done three times, but by the same trumpeter.
Okay, so the Deutsch would sync up.
Ba-ba, and do it.
All right. So,
but little things like that mean a lot. You know, little things mean a lot, as the old song goes, and they do.
Okay, so let's hear Close to You by the Carpenters. My guest is Richard Carpenter.
Do it and all.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time you walk by? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Decided to create a dream come true. So they sprinkled moon dust in your hair and golden starlight in your eyes of blue. That is why all the girls in town follow you, all around, just like.
Okay, so there's the trumpet solo with the doit that Richard Carpenter was describing. Let's skip ahead to the end of the track and get to the harmonies that you were describing. That's the signature harmonies at the end of Close to You. Richard Carpenter, is that your voice and Karen Carpenter's voice overdubbed many times?
Yes, Terry, it is. It's four-part harmony, and it's tripled, so obviously it's 12 vocal parts, 12 voices.
So you're obviously a big fan of overdubbing. Part of it sounds like it was practical, but what aesthetically, what did you like about overdubbing?
Oh, aesthetically, it's not even practical. It's, I mean, I know what you're saying, but it's the sound. It's just something that caught my ear when I was right around 3 years old and heard Les Paul and Mary Ford. That was overdubbed. Mary Ford's, well, of course, the guitars were too, but the vocals, talking about On Tiger Rag and How High the Moon. And even as a little boy, of course, my ears were always attuned to melody and arrangements and music in general and records, because Patti Page was overdubbing at the time as well, say with My Eyes Wide Open, I'm Dreaming, or Tennessee Waltz. But her harmonies were one voice per harmony, where Mary Ford's were at least two for the same part, if not more. And see, as a kid, I heard the difference even then, because it's the overdub sound in addition to what's being overdubbed that got to me. And of course, I had no idea, along with just about the rest of the world, how it was done. I remember asking my mom, how does she do it? And how does Mary Ford do it? And it reminded me what I later learned, the old joke about how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And she said, how does she do it? And Mom said, yeah, because Mom didn't. And she said, well, she practices. And I would go around the house trying to get my voice to, no kidding. So when I later found
you,
out
you thought
how
that
to
you could create
it,
two voices at the same time and sing in harmony with yourself.
I was a little kid. It's my mom, you know, the world's authority on just about everything. So I said, years later, when I learned how it was done, Karen and I took right to it because, obviously, we're, among other things, we were born to do that.
Now, you were born in 1946?
Yeah, October of 46.
So you're growing up just kind of on the cusp of, like, the Perry Como pop era and the Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry rock and roll era.
So, yeah, it was a marvelous time.
Because you got both.
Most people my age who weren't so into radio and records and songs and all that didn't really listen born around the time I was, until the rock and roll thing started to come to the surface. You know, 55, 6, especially 7 and on. See, I was different in that between my father's record collection, which was quite eclectic, and listening to the radio, I grew up with all this stuff. You know, I was listening. I remember the first record I wanted that I pestered my parents for was Mule Train.
Frankie Lane.
Frankie Lane. And when I look back, I still have it. They bought it. It was my first record in a 78. And I looked at the charts years later. Well, that was late 49. Which would have meant I had just turned 3 years old.
Didn't that actually have whips on it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But you see, that caught my...
Of course.
I was listening to the radio at 3 years old. That's what I mean. So I grew up with Guy Mitchell and Patti Page and Les Paul and Mary Ford, Joe Stafford, Perry Como, a lot of terrific records, along with the burgeoning R.B., you know, Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers.
And did you like that?
I liked it both. That's what I mean. I liked all of it. It was a magic time because, say, in 56 alone, you could have, and it was one bumped the other out of number one. Through the years, I've lost the chronology, but both on RCA. One was Hot Diggity by Perry Como. The other was Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis. And one was number one. The other was two and bumped the one. I can't remember whether Elvis bumped out Perry or Perry bumped out Elvis, but that shows you how much of a variety there was on top 40 radio at the time, and I think it was absolutely terrific.
So now, when you started performing with your sister Karen Carpenter, you were doing jazz before you were, you know, doing pop. And give us a sense of the material that you were doing as teenagers.
Well, it was light jazz, because really I'm not a born jazzer by any stretch of the imagination, but light jazz. Well, and Karen was a drummer, and had met a fellow in college named Wes Jacobs who played bass and actually was a tuba major, and we put together a trio and ended up in the finals of a Hollywood Bowl Battle of the Bands in 1966, June of 66.
Your sister Karen played drums and sang. Were people surprised when you started performing to see a female drummer, particularly a female drummer who also sang?
Well, yeah, back then, female drummers were not quite as, there weren't quite as many as there are now. So it was really...
It's an understatement.
Yeah, I imagine it is an understatement. She sang as well. Karen, she was gifted, and so she could not only sing beautifully while playing the drums. I said she did it all. So that's four things going on just with the drums, you know, the both feet and both hands, and then on top of it, she was singing. And she could do the drum fills while she was singing ballads, and it wouldn't affect her voice whatsoever.
Did she really want to sing, or did you have to kind of push her in that direction?
Oh, Karen, well, at first, I say she was, she was always interested in drumming. I mean, from the time she first developed an interest, it never really waned her interest. But, of course, her voice was still coming into its own at this time. But, yeah, I had to answer your question, I had to push her. She always, she loved music. I said we lived in New Haven. We were born in New Haven, and homes back there, as I'm sure you know, if you're not from there, even from the Midwest and the East, they have basements. And Dad had set up the music and the records and the sound and all in the basement. So I'd go down and listen a lot. And Karen would come down and listen to whatever I was listening to. But she had an innate feel for all this stuff as well. But, at first I had to coax her.
So let's hear another track that's featured on this new collection. And I thought we'd hear Goodbye to Love, which you co-wrote with your songwriting partner, John Bettis.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about how this song came together. You wrote the melody. He wrote the lyrics.
Yes, that's right. Speaking of Bing Crosby, I was watching one of his films. It was called Rhythm on the River, and in it he played a ghost songwriter, which is the famous songwriter whose name I can't remember, but the actor who portrayed him was Basil Rathbone. And in the plot, this songwriter's most famous tune was called Goodbye to Love. And you never heard a Goodbye to Love in this movie. They just referred to it. It was like his Stardust, you know. And I thought, a good name for a song. And I pictured the opening lines and the opening lyrics. So I wrote the ba-da-da-da-da-da. I'll say goodbye to love. No one ever cared if I should live or die. Well, and then I wrote the rest of the melody, and John finished the lyric. And that's what came to be.
As the composer and arranger, you pull out all the stops on this. There's strings, harp, tambourine, overdubbed harmonies. So anything else you want to say that we should listen for before we hear it?
No, not really. It's a very tricky melody. And Karen, again, her phrasing... in the early parts especially, sounded like she had three lungs full.
It is a tricky melody. Did you know that when
chromatic.
You were writing it?
What's going on there?
Yeah.
I didn't say, I am going to write a tricky melody. It's just what I heard. I said, when I watched the movie and that Goodbye to Love got planted in my head, that's what I heard was, I'll say goodbye to love. No one ever cared if I should live or die. That's not exactly in tune, but it's just what came out. I guess it's my years of listening to not only pop, but Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky and any number of other types of music. I think it's all a little bit of everything in there.
Well, it's a really great melody. So let's hear Goodbye to Love. This is the Carpenters.
I'll say goodbye to love. No one ever cared if I should live or die. Time and time again, the chance for love has passed me by. And all I know of love is how to live without it. I just can't seem to find it. So say goodbye to love. There are no tomorrows for this heart of mine. Surely time will lose these bitter memories, and I'll find that there is some.
before you were signed to A&M Records, where you had your first hit, Close to You, you were signed with RCA Records, where you had nothing.
Well,
they kind of got rid of you pretty quickly. Didn't they just buy out your contract?
Yeah, but let me explain. I understand why they did it, you know. Getting back to the Battle of the Bands at the Hollywood Bowl, it was a big deal back then. It was many years that this was sponsored by the L.A. Parks and Recreation Department. It was a big deal, and they had, it was sold out every year. They had named judges. So record labels, I didn't know this at the time, but would send out A&R men to keep their ears open for any new talent. So at the end, I say Karen and I, the trio, we won. We won several things. So we're walking out, and a fellow comes up, wants to know if we'd be interested in recording. Long and short of it is his name was Neely Plum, Plumb. And I knew that name anyway because, I, as I said, I looked for credits, songwriter credits, producers, all that stuff on records that I'd buy. The soundtrack to Bye Bye Birdie from 63 on RCA, and Neely produced that. Love the Sons of the Pioneers, and I had their Cool Water LP, I believe, from 59, and he had produced that. I knew his name. And he wanted to know, as I said, if we were interested in recording. What do you say? Oh, no! What he was picturing, because I said the one piece featured Wes on tuba, and he thought maybe rock tuba. So, again, long story short, they signed us. We were assigned because Neely was head of A&R West Coast, RCA. He assigned us a producer whom they had just hired named Rick Gerard. And so we met with him, and two of the acts that he had just been assigned, having come on board with RCA, were the Richard Carpenter Trio and Jefferson Airplane.
But I love the story how you're signed, and then they realize, well, you're not going to make it in the age of, like, psychedelic music and then Jefferson Airplane. You know, you're not right for the label and what they're putting out. So then you end up with, was it with your bass player getting a job at Disney's Main Street USA? Oh, this is with John Bettis, your song co-writer. So you get a job at Disney's Main Street USA at a place called Coke Corner, and I've seen a picture of you playing there, and you're both wearing, you know, like the old trad Dixieland kind of restaurant costume of of like the brimmed hat and the garter on your arm.
Yeah, it's
very
the
corny
straw hat and it's really not corny. Because, as you know, especially if you've ever worked there, you're part of a cast.
Right.
And you're supposed to, be true to the period you're representing. So Main Street USA was, it's now turn of last century, but at the time it was turn of the century America. And so all the people who work at the shops and all, they're dressed in period correct garb. And if you picture a quintessential or stereotypical barbershop quartet, that's what it was. You know, it was a brocaded vest, long sleeves, a garter in the arm, a straw hat, and you were supposed to play pieces that existed at this point in time.
Which was what? What was your repertoire there?
Well, On the Sidewalks of New York, and By the Light of the Silvery Moon, and a lot of singable old songs like that. We didn't do what we were supposed to, and people would come in. I mean, we'd do a lot of that, and there were cards with lyrics to these songs on the table, so if people wanted to sing along. It was very much the way Shakey's Pizza
Parlor. That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yep, that's... And I don't know which one was the chicken and which was the egg, whether it was Shakey's or Disney, but that's what it was like.
Shakey's was like a sing-along pizza parlor where there'd be, like, you know, old-fashioned songs that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Banjo and piano. And uh-huh. Oh, yeah. But what we did, which we certainly shouldn't have, was answer requests from, the folks who would come in for newer songs. like Somewhere My Love was pretty new at the time, and Yesterday, and well, this was what turned out to be when we played there, The Summer of Love, 1967. So Light My Fire was one of the big ones, and kids would come in and say, can you play Light My Fire?
I said,
sure.
Great. This is great. You're playing Light My Fire in the straw hat and the brocaded vase,
that's the
vest
thing.
And the garter belt.
Course,
the garter around your arm.
Those songs didn't exist then. See, we were supposed to do what we were told is what we were supposed to do, and we didn't. So it's a wonder we stayed there as long as we did before we were shown the door.
Some people thought of the Carpenters as just kind of like old-fashioned pop or even corny pop. And then you get somebody coming along like the band Sonic Youth, which takes a song that the Carpenters made famous, Superstar, puts a totally different spin on it musically. And I'm wondering what you thought of that.
Well, I have to speak to this corny business.
Yeah, do.
Yeah.
And
it's
can I make a confession
American
to you?
American pop is what it is. And,
okay.
You know, there are ignoramuses who say that.
Okay, I'm going to make a confession to you here, okay? I used to think that you guys were really corny. And it took me a while to really, hear what was so good about, the melodies, the arrangements, her singing. I mean, so it took me a while to come around, I'll confess. But so do you know the Sonic Youth version, which was also referred to in the movie Juno?
Yes, I do.
What do you think of it?
I don't like it.
Why don't you like it?
Why would I like it?
Yeah?
At least when it comes to something like this, I will say I don't care for it, but I don't understand it. So I'm not going to say it's good or it's bad. I'm just going to say I don't care for it.
Should we play a little bit of it so our listeners can hear what
we're
talking about?
Oh, sure, let's.
I see you're really enthusiastic. Okay, just give me the liberty to do this just so what we're talking about makes some sense to listeners. And Sonic Youth is a kind of like indie noise band. So here's in fact, why don't we just play them both back to back so we get to hear you too. So here's the Carpenters and Sonic Youth doing Superstar.
Long ago and oh so far away, I fell in love with you. Before the second show, your guitar, it sounds so sweet and clear, but you're not really here, it's just the radio. Thank you.
Earth and the Sonic Youth take on Superstar. My guest is Richard Carpenter, and there's 40 Carpenter's tracks on a new anthology, which is called 4040, released on the 40th anniversary of their signing to A&M Records. There's some tracks on this, there's a bunch of tracks on this anthology that I didn't know existed. And one of them that I especially like to play is called Now. And this was recorded late in your sister's life in around 1982, and you did the mix after she died in 83. It's a really beautiful recording, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this recording, why you chose to do it.
Oh yeah, it's a Now is a piece by Roger Nichols, a melody writer who wrote We've Only Just Begun, Rainy Days and Mondays, I'm the Last Day Without You, among others. And it's a piece we did in April of 1982. It's what's called a work lead, a lead that the singer would put on as the tracking musicians. In this case, the bass and drummer, the bassman and drummer, could hear how it, rather than just look at a chart with chord changes and all, you could hear how the melody goes, and then it would be replaced with a master lead at, well, at a future date. But Karen sang these things so well that, you know, the scratch lead works just dandy. So originally it was just bass, piano, and drums accompaniment and Karen's lead, and then in the coming months I finished the chart. And mixed it, and yeah, it's a really pretty song, and Karen sings it. Well, she sings it beautifully.
She does. So let's hear it. This is Now, and it's featured on the New Carpenters anthology 4040.
Now, when it rains, I don't feel cold. Now that I have your hand to hold. Blow through me, but I don't care. There's no harm in thunder if you are there. And now when you touch my feelings fly. Now when I'm smiling, I know why. You light up my world like the morning sun. You're so deep within.
Carpenters, and it's featured on the new Carpenters anthology 4040. My guest is Richard Carpenter. Do you think your sister Karen realized what a good voice she had, or do you think because it was such a natural thing for her that she just took it for granted and didn't understand what a gift she had?
I've been asked that plenty, and I've thought about it plenty. Karen at once could realize that she could do just about anything vocally. And when it came to recording, as far as punching in or anything, she just knew, the both of us knew, we can do that. So to me, Karen at once both knew just what an instrument she possessed and a gift. At the same time, I don't really know. I tend to think, no. It's very hard. It's hard for me to answer. I'll tell you, Terry.
I can understand that.
And, you know, being human, we do tend to take things for granted. So I honestly can't answer that one. I've tried.
All right.
I mean, I've tried before, you know. I'm not quite certain.
One of your really famous recordings, We've Only Just Begun, countless people have marched down the aisle to that. The song, from the story I've read, the story...
Yeah, for good or ill.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
The song was originally, at least the melody, was going to be a jingle for a bank advertising campaign in California. So
yeah, it was a lyric. It was a lyric, too. We've only just begun. It was...
That was the lyric for the bank ad?
Yeah. It was... Well, it was a very effective ad. It was a soft sell. It was for the Crocker Bank. It was written by Roger Nichols and Paul Williams specifically for this campaign. And, it showed a young couple. It was filmed, and it had that gauzy look to it, and you saw the rice being thrown, and then they drive off into the evening, and as they're driving into the sunset, the Chiron came up, and I can't remember whether a voiceover was with it or just the Chiron, but you've only just begun. Let us help you get there. The Crocker.
That's great.
The Crocker Bank. I mean, it was a very effective commercial, and I heard that a couple of times, and I'm thinking, well, I knew darn well it was by Nichols and Williams because I recognized Paul's voice. And I thought, if the song is a whole song, because I said you don't hear the whole thing on the commercial, I think, done the right way, it's a hit.
So you suggested recording it.
I write about that. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
That was my idea. That's what I say. You know, that's...
You can recognize a hit.
One of my talents is, at least used to be, recognizing a diamond in the rough, as it were. So... And boy, and it became the wedding song of a generation. My goodness. it worked very well for our harmonies as well as Karen's lead. And it was a nice combination of more softer pop at times and then had a little more edge to it and rhythm in the bridge. I had brass stabs and the vocals going on. And I like the together. When I first heard the demo, bridge ends with together. And right then and there, before I got it to the piano, I thought the second time we're going to sing together and then go up and together. I mean, it's an arranger's dream, that song.
Thank you so much for coming on Fresh Air. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Richard Carpenter.
Oh, sure, Terry. Thank you.
Richard Carpenter was one half of the Carpenters with his sister Karen. A CD collection was recently released featuring 40 tracks commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Carpenters signing with A&M Records. It's called 4040.
We've only just begun to live, white lace and promises, a kiss for luck and we're on our way.
We've only begun.
Before the rising sun, we fly. So many roads to choose. We start out walking and learn to
The 76-year-old writer Cormac McCarthy is often cited as one of the best living American novelists. His 1992 novel, All the Pretty Horses, won a National Book Award, and Joel and Ethan Coen made No Country for Old Men into an Oscar-winning film. His post-apocalyptic novel, The Road, won a Pulitzer Prize and was one of the few downbeat Oprah Book Club selections. The Road has been adapted into a new film, starring Viggo Mortensen. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
In an era rich in doomsday movies, The Road is the doomiest. It's closely based on a novel by Cormac McCarthy, who's grown more and more apocalyptic in his old age. He doesn't explain the origin of the blinding light we see in flashback that heralds the dying of the planet and the end of civilization. Nukes? A meteor? Project on it what you will. But he makes it clear he thinks human society will unravel quickly. The road of the road is paved with cannibals looking to capture and consume their fellow humans. But that road is also a metaphor for the blind instinct to survive. A father, called only the man, has one goal, to keep his starving son, the boy, alive, both eating and uneaten. Director John Hillcoat made his debut with the cruel, brutal Australian Western, The Proposition. And if anything, he's too in sync with McCarthy. There's no relief from the bleakness. Viggo Mortensen plays the man, bearded, smudged, greasy-haired. He exhorts his son to keep what he calls the fire inside. And that's what we see in his unblinking eyes as his body wastes away. There was once a mother, the woman, played by Charlize Theron. We see her in The Man's Dreams. But she gave up early on her family. Only the father goes on. He says in voiceover, "The child is my warrant. If he is not the word of God, then God never spoke." His impulse might have as much to do with Darwin, with the evolutionary imperative to keep the species going, but it amounts to the same thing. When the man and boy meet up with the old man, played by a barely recognizable Robert Duvall, the two share a rare philosophical moment over their meager meal.
I knew this was coming. This was something like it. There were warnings. Yeah. Thought it was a con. I always believed in it. You were the last man left alive.
How would you know that? That you were the last man alive?
Well, I guess you know it. You just knew it.
Maybe God would know.
Would know what. If there is a God up there, he would have turned his back on us by now. And whoever made humanity will find no humanity here. No, sir. So beware.
What a tough, wily actor Duvall is. His old man is nearly blind and enfeebled. When we first see him, he appears senile. Then Duvall gives us glimmers of his caginess. This is a survival mechanism, too, affecting frailty to keep from being attacked. For an instant, it seems possible the man and boy will adopt him as a surrogate Gramps, but the man sees him only as a drain on their food. As much as the man fights for his son, their points of view do conflict. The boy never knew the Brotherhood of Man era, yet he pleads in a whiny voice that hasn't broken to share their food, and trembles with grief when his fiercely single-minded father remains unswayed by humanist pleas. The man doesn't bully him, though. Maybe part of him wants to keep the boy a boy. Are we the good guys, his son asks over and over, like a question chanted in prayer? Yes, says his father. But when he punishes and humiliates an inept, rather pathetic thief, played by Michael Kenneth Williams, who was Omar on The Wire, it's hard to know who's good. I know people who've seen The Road and think highly of it, but wonder, why did they make that book into a movie? It's so hard to sit through. Part of me agrees, not because it's a downer, but because it's so unrelieved that it verges on monotony. At times I found myself asking, what is the point? But I also thought of critic Kenneth Tynan's review of Titus Andronicus. It is our English heresy to think of poetry as a gentle way of saying gentle things, he wrote. Titus reminds us it is also a harsh way of saying harsh things. The film of The Road achieves a kind of sublimity, sublime not in the sense of noble, but most extreme. Horrific as Mortensen looks, he has a primal, haggard beauty, an indelible image of man in extremis.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.